Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends, and welcome to the World Transform. Program is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie before us, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So when does this amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Man, it's Friday, so I'm great.
Happy Friday, everybody. Happy Friday, and we've got a fantastic topic tonight. We're going to be talking about one of my favorite subjects, actually. We're going to be talking about the human imagination, the thing that the future is going to transcend, I say, every time we do a show, somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So is the imagination the critical future skill? And if so, what can it do for us in terms of being ready for the future? What can it do for us in terms of the things that we're going to have to do in the future? Well, we've got some indicators around that here this evening. And let's just jump right in. I'm going to start with this very interesting piece that was over on eon.co, Why Our Imagination for Alien Life is So Impoverished. And I don't know if you read this, Stephen, but I came to the end of thinking, well, I sort of see the guy's point. Our imagination for aliens is probably overly guided by what has been popular in science fiction, and it's going to be totally dominated by, you know, what we imagine ourselves to be like under different circumstances. But to really, truly imagine aliens, that's got to be one of the hardest things in the world, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, our similar frames of, you know, we won't have a lot as far as, you know, similar frames of reference, I wouldn't imagine. You know, if their beginning is completely different from ours. Now, it stands to reason that life will be carbon-based. You know, I mean, it's pretty much understood that's the way it'll have to be. You know, and there will likely be something like DNA. That's what life requires as a plan.
Or at least it started out that way. It could be silicon-based by the time we encounter it, right?
Right. Well, but, you know, and even back the original Star Trek episode had a silicon-based life form. It looked like a rock and, you know, a spore. they thought it was a rock, and it turns out it was actual creature that was silicon-based life form. But since that episode, Phil, they've about decided that silicon just doesn't provide the it's close to what carbon does, but we seem to think that carbon is the way it will have to be. But so we think it has to have some sort of plan for building. That's, you know, something.
No, I just meant it could have started out based on carbon, and now it's silicon, right?
So you're talking like a machine-based life. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, exactly.
That's true. But I would expect that if aliens were to actually show up and make themselves known to us here in our solar system, I would expect that it would be machine-based, because carbon-based life forms just aren't really made to travel, the galaxy, at least using the technology we know. So unless they show up with warp drive or something, it would have to be a some sort of machine based technology, but something a little more akin to 2001, right? But it starts out as it'd start out as regular carbon based life, but it could be a million different things that we wouldn't even think to imagine. and not look at all like the bumpy-faced aliens from Star Trek or something.
Yeah, and when we try to imagine aliens, we have to start with some common reference. So I think it only makes sense to picture them as, you know, insects or jellyfish or, you know, or just apes or whatever. I mean, you know, a familiar life form that has been modified in some way, you know, to at least get a handle on how different the dominant life form might be in another world. But to truly imagine aliens, you almost have to do it by absence. And although I realize that we've said that, you know, maybe science fiction isn't the best place to go, the best portrayal I can ever recall of that captures how mysterious aliens could be, it was, did you ever read Sphere by Michael Crichton?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So those aliens, we never see them, and we don't know anything about them. In fact, we're not even sure they're aliens. They could be humans from the future, because casual time travel is kind of hinted at as well. But all we have is their artifact, and their artifact is this machine that turns your thoughts into reality. So it's already this highly advanced technology. And the one thing we know reasonably certain is that turning people's thoughts into reality is not why they invented it to begin with. So we've got these completely baffling creatures far in advance of us who create a capability that we would kill for. I mean, you know, people on this planet would kill to have that capability. And it's probably just a byproduct of whatever it was they were trying to do. To me, those are like the most baffling and confounding and mysterious aliens I can remember from anywhere.
I saw something that I thought was very cool. It was an imagination of, you know, what aliens could look like, and it was so alien that, you know, I said, you know, this might be closer to how alien something will be when we find it than what we've previously seen in sci-fi movies or something. It showed these creatures that were basically gas-based creatures on a planet with a light with light gravity, and that could, you know, change their elevation and they were kind of grazing like cattle on the side of on a hillside and changing their elevation up and down the hillside based on internal gas pressures, and
wow.
You know, of course and their mouths looked like more like trunks or something. It was really a alien looking creature I thought that was pretty imaginative, and I like that. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, I like it too. I think anything that makes us stretch our boundaries is good.
Yeah.
And anything that ultimately just kind of confounds our expectations is good. Because if one day we are going to encounter aliens, they will confound us to some extent, right? They will be mysterious to us in ways that it's hard to predict. And we're going to need every bit of our imaginations to prepare ourselves for that ahead of time, but also just to deal with it if and when it comes up. So I think that's that one is a good kind of introductory instance of why we need imagination to deal with the challenges of the future. Here's another one where imagination is actually being, it sounds like, very effectively applied. Scientists are using stories to teach human values to computers. Now, it was about a week and a half ago, maybe a week ago, we were talking about the three laws of robotics and, you know, how do we get artificial intelligence to at least have these as goals, right? To at least adopt the idea of, I don't want to hurt people, and I want to, you know, protect people when I can, and I want to, you know, protect my own existence. You know, those basic core ideas that are embodied in the three laws of robotics. How do you get those into the head of, quote unquote, the head of an artificial intelligence? Well, here's one way: is telling stories to artificial intelligence, telling stories to the robots, and letting them learn values from the stories. And I have to say, what this one has going for it is, come to think of it, that's how we've always tried to teach them to humans, isn't it?
Right. You expect children to arrive as these selfish little need machines, right? I mean,
yep.
You know, that they don't have concept of, you know, perhaps I should not disturb mom and dad. It's in the middle of the night and they might need the rest. They don't care. All they know is that I'm wet, I'm hungry, I'm, you know, I'm bored, you know, I'm gassy or whatever. They, you know, I have a need and therefore I need to scream. That's and that's what little babies are like. And so and these little people progress from that point to their toddler years where they're still self-centered and everything, but they begin to have some concept of you know, people outside of themselves and what their needs may be. And further and further on all through childhood until, you know, a little adult is produced or a full-grown adult is produced and hopefully is a kind person, is a generous person, but also self-motivated and fully mature. And that's so I guess what you're in part doing here is giving these machines some background, the same, giving them a childhood. I'm reminded, Phil, of Blade Runner. Do you know what the scene I'm talking about?
No, tell me.
Okay,
remind
so
me.
Okay, Blade Runner. These replicant people, and I presume they were mostly biological, but may have had some machine elements to them. The replicants were. They said, well, in order to control them and to give them, you know, because they just had no, you know, boundaries or they had no emotional maturity. So what we've begun to do is to give them a past. And
oh, right.
Deckard,
yeah.
And Deckard said, oh, you're talking about memories. You're giving them memories of having a childhood. And yeah, that's exactly what we're doing. I thought that, you know, so I guess in a way that's kind of what they're doing with these artificial intelligences is they're giving them something like a childhood, maybe.
Something to hook into. That the program is called Quixote, named after Don Quixote, the famous Cervantes novel. Speaking of imagination, that is a novel about a man whose imagination has gotten the better of him. Right? He lives in a world pretty much that he's creating on the fly. But this is very straightforward, you know, right out of the old book from the 60s or 70s parenting that this thing seems to implement. Basically, it's reinforcing the right behaviors with the child. So, you know, exactly what you were talking about, Stephen, that goes on in our human childhoods. They're replicating that with these artificial intelligences. If you make the morally aligned decision, there is a payoff for that. And if you don't, you don't get the payoff. It sounds so, I don't know, almost simple-minded and mercenary when you put it that way, but that is exactly how we all learn to be good, right? I mean,
We come here as little scientists in a way. We do experiments and, you know, social experiments. If I do this, then it results in me getting an ice cream cone. And if I do this thing, then mom and dad will be displeased. And I won't get that ice cream cone. And, that's how we learn, isn't it? So. It makes sense that we would do the same thing. Now, of course, we're talking much simpler. You know, there's no full-fledged childhood here. But I imagine as we begin to produce more and more sophisticated AIs, they're going to have a more and more sophisticated training procedure like this, giving them, what approaches a real childhood.
Yeah, and I think the idea of training is really important. I mean, that is what goes on in these neural networks systems, these AI systems. You know, you train it. It learns how to learn something, and that is analogous to childhood. The thing is, a computer might be able to go through its childhood really quickly. That's the difference. But I don't think it would be quite as simple as the Blade Runner model, where you just implant it. I think there is something about there actually being a process of coming to this that is somehow significant to it. Let me read a quick passage from the story here. I think this is interesting. A hypothetical example is a robot tasked with picking up emergency over-the-counter medication as quickly as possible. The robot has the choice to take the medicine and leave without paying, interact politely with the pharmacist, or wait in line. Without the value alignment and positive reinforcement Quixote provides, the robot would simply grab and dash with the medicine, right? By rewarding the robot for waiting patiently, Quixote performs the needed correction to ensure that the robot is in line with human values. Now, presumably, you could take a new computer and just immediately program it with that input already, right? It's like,
right.
It's a copy and paste, and as far as it's concerned, it had that experience. So I guess you actually could implant them with memories. But however it comes by that memory, that actual process of having, you know, made the decision and gotten the reward, and having, you know, made the connection that I should not steal things, I shouldn't be nice to people, built in that way, it seems like, you know, this makes me feel more confident that we might actually have nice robots than most of the things I've read about how this is being tackled, frankly.
If every single human being that, you know, reaches adulthood is, you know, there is a wide spectrum of how mentally, you know, healthy these people are when they reach adulthood, right? I mean, you know, you have very stable individuals that are, you know, kind and generous and hardworking and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then you have the criminally insane and everything in between, right? But it seems to me that if you produce an AI that's criminally insane, you don't reproduce that. You run the iterations over and over and over again until you produce the AI equivalent of an enlightened individual, okay?
Right.
And that's the one that okay, now we got a good one. Okay, this is the one. We're going to use this AI over and over again, and we'll produce, you know, however many of these AIs that we want in the world, we'll produce them. And you can count on these AIs to be a lot more stable by and large than individuals, and perhaps it's extremely important, I think, that every single one of them be mentally stable, right?
Well, the great thing is ultimately, you know, what you can do is once you have the perfect AI childhood, you can give every new AI the perfect childhood, right?
Every one of them has that.
That's the beauty.
Yeah,
you know, it's not the trial and error that we have to go through to have a good childhood. You know, it'll work out. That's very encouraging. Okay, what's next? We've got to talk about.
I wanted to bring up this seven deadly sins of world building article, Phil, that I saw over on Gizmodo, and.
Okay.
It's a very interesting article. We won't go through the seven deadly sins of world building. I encourage everybody to check it out. It's pretty cool. It's things like it's a sin if you're building a world to not think about basic infrastructure, and that's number one. Number two is not explaining why events are happening at this particular point in your novel or whatever it is, your story or whatever it is you're producing, your movie or whatever, but I think it comes down to this. You have to, if you're building a fictional world, if you're using your imagination field to do something like that, you got to live in it a while before, you know, you got to take the time, as people like J.R.R. Tolkien did. He spent a lot of time building that world and thinking hard about, well, you know, how does this work and how does that work? You know, and then worlds like Dune, you know,
right.
Frank Herbert, he obviously to have that lived-in feeling that comes across in novels, wow, this seems so real. How did he do that? Well, a lot of work is how that happens. You know, you got the writer, the author spent a lot of time thinking about the minutia, things that may, you know, never even make the novels.
Right.
You ask the author, well, how does this work in your world, and he could tell you. He or she
right.
could tell you that.
But you can read in the writing that detail is there, even if you don't read
it. It's
that
there.
Detail.
It's in the background. You can kind of, you get that feeling, and you can't fake that. It's
right.
In order to have that come across in the writing, you have to have lived in that world mentally, and so anyway, that's you know, I wanted to, you know, point everybody at that article. I think it's great. You should check it out. But I just wanted to use that to kind of launch into talking about, you know, growing up in the 60s and 70s and 80s, Phil, for me, and, you know, and what that was like versus now. And, I mean, free time for me, Phil, growing up, I mean, when, you know, when the school was done and I got my homework done, it was pretty much sitting there passively absorbing, you know, absorbing the television, and less often maybe reading a book or something. But it was
same here. Yeah, I read and watch TV.
That was pretty much it. You know, and when I had a chance, and played with the neighborhood kids, things like that. And then,
sure.
And we had some simple video games, but so there's some interactive entertainment. And of course, playing with the neighborhood kids is interactive entertainment. But it's but by and large, it was passive. I have seen with my own children, Phil, that it seems like they spend less and less time watching television. It's doing passive things just doesn't hold the same interest to them as doing things that are interactive. And it, you know, part of it is just that the interactive entertainment has gotten better and better. But and it's not just doing first person shooters, although they love that kind of stuff. I think what they love most of all is world building. They, you know, things like Minecraft, where they get to go in there and, you know, and build their own houses and do, you know, and various shared worlds like that, where they can, all four of my kids, got their laptops there right there in the living room while I'm sitting there watching TV or something. They're doing that. Now, what are you guys doing? Show me what you, you know, and it could be those four plus, you know, some friends or maybe, a cousin or something elsewhere, all sharing, you know, and talking on Skype and talking amongst themselves there in the same room too. Come check this out, guys. Check out what I did here and there. And so I just think that's kind of an interesting, world building is not just for the novelists and the screenwriters and things like that. It's for everybody now. And technology is allowing that. I think it's a cool thing. I think it's a more stimulating way to spend your free time than
obviously it is, or they wouldn't be doing it, right? Because TV's still there, right? If this wasn't more compelling to them, they'd be watching TV. But what are they doing? They're building their world, and of course they are, because this is this shared experience, this interactive experience, this creative experience, and I think this probably makes the case for why imagination is the critical skill of the future. It's just also the critical enabler of being able to do things that we couldn't do before, because you can have the you can have Minecraft, but what activates it, right? What makes it go? It's the imagination of your kids and their friends as they're in there doing something with it, right? That whole experience is being driven by what they're able to come up with in their own brains. I think that's awesome, and I'm very happy that the world has moved in that direction. You know, I like being a kid, and I like watching TV and reading and all that kind of stuff. But I think it's very exciting to see that kids have a completely different experience now, driven by their imaginations, basically limited only by that too, isn't it?
Even when my oldest is off to college, he's often, you know, in the evenings, it's not an unusual thing for him to Skype in and, you know, talk with his brothers and with his mother and I about, you know, here's what I did with my day today. And, and when he talks with his brothers, he often, you know, when he's sharing with them what college is like, I mean, it fires their imagination and gets them thinking in that direction, which as a dad, I have to be excited about. Right. But, the ways they spend their free time is you often hear, well, you know, the way these kids these days don't do this.
The kids
and that
these
and that.
Days are the
worst.
They dance.
Well,
yeah,
I have to say that, what they do has to be more compelling and more prone to firing the imagination than sitting there passively absorbing the Dukes of Hazzard. Okay, which is a good portion of my childhood. Okay?
As fun as that was, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And as awesome of a show as that was, have you watched that as an adult, by the way?
No, I haven't. I barely watched it when it was on TV as a kid.
Yeah, yeah.
I haven't had a chance to revisit.
You can't go home again. That's all.
Let's not even try. Let's keep pushing on. I think we want to talk finally about, and I think this is a great setup for this, Huffington Post, 5 reasons imagination is more important than reality. Well, I think that kind of statement is just asking for trouble. Is it more important than reality? I don't know. But it's way important. It's more important than it used to be. That's for sure. And the reasons they give here, they're pretty good. It ignites passion. True. Number 2, I think, is key. Our imagination and thoughts create our future. And I'm going to come back to that. It stimulates creativity and innovation. That's what you're talking about with your kids, right? I mean, it's addictive, right? You know, if you can produce something with your imagination, that's just, that's a rush. Which leads you to number 4, that it's magical. There's, watch a kid pretending, and you see how effective imagination actually is in the world. And then finally, number 5, sometimes reality just sucks. I think that's true. But imagination is not only just an alternative to reality that sucks. It's also one of the ways we address the fact that reality sucks. It's one of the tools we use to fix, a reality that sucks. And as I look over this list, what I think is missing from it, and that what you've really encapsulated well, Stephen, with your example, is the reason imagination is so much more important. It's always been important. But the reason I think it's more important today than it has ever been before is, in the past, up to a point, what were you going to do with it, right?
Yeah.
What were you going to do with
it? You didn't have the
daydream was about it, you know?
Yeah, you didn't have tools for the imagination. You didn't have tools for the imagination like you have now. So it's just, absolutely.
You know, you can make up your own stories, you know, on paper, but you couldn't create these shared worlds, and you didn't get the immediate... I was talking about sphere earlier. Ultimately, that's kind of where we're headed, right? Ultimately, we're kind of headed to machinery that just takes imagination and turns it into reality. And that's another reason why it's such an important skill, is because we're able to do so much more with our imaginations than we could in the past. We have gained leverage on imagination that we didn't have before. And now what you can imagine can become something in a sense that it that it couldn't in the past. So,
yeah. Well, I would say that the people that you and I admire the most, Bill, have a foot in both worlds. Okay,
yeah.
I mean, Elon Musk, Ray Kurzweil, Diamantis, just all these fascinating guys that have done so much in the world. They obviously live in the real world along with the rest of us, and they see the world as it is. But they also spent a whole lot of time imagining how what the world could be, and then they worked to get from here to there. And you got to have imagination, and you have to understand how the real world is. And we've all encountered the completely boring people that would look at the things that would listen to one of our podcasts and say, these two guys. These middle-aged guys really need to grow well. I mean, come on.
Right.
The stuff they're talking about is silly. It doesn't affect my life. In my life, I got to get up in the morning and go to work, and I've got this to do and that to do, and who cares about this crap? Well, here's the thing. If you have no concept of the world as it could be, then you really are not going to do much to change the world as it is. And so you have to have imagination. So, at any rate, yeah, you gotta have foot in both worlds, but imagination is a critical skill and becoming more and more so all the time.
And we're here for you, folks. If you want more things to imagine, come back to this same place next week, and we're going to have 3 more big shows talking about, just feeding the imagination. That's what we do. Stephen, it's been great this week, and look forward to being with you again next week.
Absolutely.
And thank you all for being with us. We will be back with 3 brand new shows next week. And until next time, live to see it.